She was never much for thoughts and prayers, but you can honor her memory by loving one another and by fighting like hell. To see all our interviews with Barbara Ehrenreich, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a people and culture manager. Go to democracynow.org for more info and apply. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
From July 2nd through September 24th, the Jazz Loft presents its summer music series. The event, hosted by Tom Pastilio and Mickey Conlon at Douglas Elliman Real Estate, includes performers John Pizzarelli on August 13th and Peter Cincotti on September 24th. For more information, tickets, and reservations, visit thejazzloft.org. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook.
And you can hear us at 90.1 FM and 107.3 FM, if you try really hard. And it is WUSB Stony Brook. It's 15 seconds to 6 o'clock on a Tuesday night, which means, once again, it's time for Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi, I'm over here.
Yeah, you are. It's rather, what's the word, dreary today. It's rather, rather dim, rather unsunny, rather undry. It's raining. It's raining. It hasn't rained in a long time here. I mean, you know, a serious rain, not the kind of, like, here's a thunderstorm, you know, go choke on that for a while. No, all-day rain. We haven't had one of those almost all summer. We had kind of like a hidden drought because people around here didn't really know it was a drought. I guess if you thought about it, it's like, yeah, I haven't seen rain in a while. It's probably not good. It's not like the droughts out west where they really do it in style with burning down entire counties and things like that. But today it rained. Well, last night it rained, and it's going to rain into tomorrow. And gosh darn it all, I know it's controversial, but I think it's good. I will say that. I will say I think it's good that there's rain. And I got to say, the weathermen have really been tripping over themselves, not knowing what to say. You know, I caught a guy, I don't want to name names because it'll just embarrass people, but basically they were talking about a possibility of rain. They were saying, okay, we dodged a bullet there, so we won't have any rain. When rain is the thing we need, you know, to replenish the reservoirs and water the plants and things like that. You know, it's a good thing. So you can't be in the mode of saying, oh boy, we don't want rain. We want everything to be nice so that you can go outside in the sun. Enough sun already. Enough. We need the water. So, you know, the next break, this guy had a different tune saying, yeah, of course, we need the rain. So we do want to have rain, but we also want to be outside in the sun. You can't teach an old dog new tricks, I guess.
I think that that's a real crisis with the kinds of on-air casts, weather casts and forecasts that we get, because there's all these assumptions that are based on, I don't know, they're so ingrained, and I think he caught himself in saying, in correcting it, but maybe not.
The station manager caught him.
They really need to have a serious discussion about standards and what the protocol is for referring to a nice day, because your interpretation of a nice day might not be a nice day for somebody else. And these old school stereotypes in how we describe different types of weather, they give things like rain a really bad rep.
Yeah.
And rain is not as bad as it's been made out to be.
It's a microaggression, I think. I take offense at it.
Oh, and don't even begin to talk about a wind and the types of things that have been said about that.
Uh-huh. There might be a hurricane coming. There might be, what's Earl? Is that the name? You know, I want to see windy, stormy weather. You know, you tell me what a nice day is. I don't say a day like today is a nice day. I say, you know, a day where there's all kinds of drama out there in the sky. That's a good day. That's an interesting day. Don't like it all being the same. But hopefully this drought will come to an end. I know today will help. It won't completely fix it, but we need all the rain we can get. And that goes for other parts of the country and the world as well. Oh, my God. Everywhere it seems there's not enough rain, or there's just excessive heat. Right now in California, they're looking at 115 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just unfathomable for places that people live. And of course, there's other parts of the world where that is the norm, and they're going up to 125. So it's just, climate change is no fun. But you know what is fun? The powwow. We went to the Shinnecock powwow this weekend out in Southampton. First time for me, first time for you, I imagine,
yep.
Too. And it was really, really awesome. Just basically the Shinnecock Nation out there. Throws this huge gathering, first time I think in 3 years that it's been open to the public because of COVID, and it was nothing like what I expected. It was so much bigger and so much more lively and filled with enthusiasm and humor, and I can't recommend it enough. Of course, it wasn't really covered anywhere because our media kind of ignores anything having to do with Native people or First Nations or any of that. But I got to tell you, next Labor Day weekend. I assume it's on Labor Day weekend each year. Definitely head down there, and you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, it's more than what it seems, and you just have to kind of take it in. And I just kept realizing I'm just witnessing some really outstanding dancing and athleticism and passion just for and showing off of like incredible costumes known as regalia. Mm-hmm. If you're there witnessing it, you hear that referred to, and of course the sounds.
Yeah.
There's just incredible drumming and singing that was going on, several impromptu readings and solos of sorts for different aspects of the event, on and on and on throughout the day. And you just become part of that ambiance and spirit. And there's so much activity, people taking it in themselves, shopping at some of the vendors, booths, and
over 100 vendors. Unbelievable.
Incredible, yeah. And they've invited, as you said, invited people back in, so a lot of the public was there as well. It was great mm-hmm. to see it really well attended.
Yeah.
By all kinds of people near and far.
But you mentioned the dancing, and yeah, the dancing was simply incredible because it encompassed every age group, basically every background, and especially seeing kids getting so into this. You know, completely dressed up and native dancing and all that. And also the music. You mentioned the music. My one critique is that I think the music should be more visible because you heard the drumming, you heard the singing. And I just assumed when I saw the dancing that they were the ones doing the singing. But no, the singing takes place kind of off stage.
The drummers are singing.
Yeah, the drummers are the ones singing. And I walked up to where they were behind stage, and it's something to see because you know, they are truly into the whole spirit of the event. And you have all sorts of different age groups, but also the people, they all look very different. Like I saw one guy with just a backwards baseball cap, looked like he could have been, you know, a truck driver on an interstate somewhere. But he was part of the native community, and his voice echoed just like everyone else's voice. And it had that unique native style to it. And of course the drumming, and you saw, old people drumming, you saw young people drumming. It's just, it was so inclusive and welcoming.
A lot of encouragement for teaching and learning and, sharing knowledge and then interpreting those styles. And you saw some of that improvisation, some of that growth happen as you were there. And I don't know. I mean, people compliment themselves on finding high art and all these, prestigious places. Well, it's all around you, and this to me rivals anything you could witness, you know, in some formal performance space. This whole stage that mm-hmm. that they have is itself. It's called the drum, and it's basically a semicircle, a raised semicircle with grass, and the grand entrances go around the front of it, and then they go up and come in from backstage, essentially, where the drummers are encircled and performing. And then as the different events occur, the performers with their numbers, of course, because they're judged,
right.
They come up there and go for a stint in whatever event is up next, and they just keep cycling through that throughout. But the stage itself was great because it's actually painted to resemble the edges of a drum as you look around the front of the stage. So it looks like a massive, massive drum. And they really provided the sound to match the size as far as it looked.
Wow. I didn't know all that. That's something.
I love that detail, just how they built their performance space. You know, we were in the bleachers and walking around. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of everybody there probably really was a big part of the magic and having fun just relaxing, and it was great weather too. It would have happened rain or shine. Postpone when it's on.
I had fry bread for the first time. So did you?
Yes. Yeah. Well, they had a great sandwich sort of thing. I didn't know you could put toppings on fry bread, but I'd heard a lot about it, and maybe had, let's say, knockoffs of it in carnival and fairs. But this was a little bit different, let's say not as sugary and incredible, but sweet nonetheless. It's a great, like, sticky kind of soft, round bread that's kneaded into a small circle, and then they throw it into the fryer.
I'm going to read you from Wikipedia just one sentence about the history of fry bread, because I knew very little about this, but there really is an incredible history to it. According to Navajo tradition, fry bread was created in 1864 using the flour, sugar, and lard that was given to them by the United States government when the Navajo who were living in Arizona were forced to make the 300-mile journey known as the Long Walk and relocate to New Mexico onto land that could not easily support their traditional staples of vegetables and beans. It's I guess a symbol of adaptation, of survival, and it's something that it means something to so many people. People were lined up for 45 minutes just to get a piece, or to get one of the toppings that you mentioned, and it was incredible. And then when we came back later. We've been watching this this program called Reservation Dogs, which I cannot recommend highly enough. It takes place in Oklahoma, the only reason that we found out about it was because last year when we were traveling cross country, we traveled through Oklahoma, wound up in one of the towns where
Muskogee.
Yeah, we were looking up the history and happened to mention that Reservation Dogs is filmed here. So we looked into Reservation Dogs and saw some episodes, fell in love with it. And I got to say, it's probably one of the best shows out there. And it just it teaches you so much about the Native community. It's done in a very humorous way. Which, yeah, that is something that impresses me more than anything else, is when you can laugh at yourself. That is a true sign of strength.
Reservation humor.
But
yeah.
There's such sadness in it as well. It's such an incredible program. Find episodes. I think it's on Hulu or something, but just do whatever you have to do to get episodes of that, because it's amazing. Anyway, when we came back and watched an episode of that, guess what they were eating? Fried bread. So we knew what it was. We wouldn't have known a day earlier because we had never seen it before. But it's got this distinctive shape to it, and it's just we felt so included, and it was such an amazing thing.
Yeah, that was just the most coincidental thing, that they're having the same style of snack or lunch in the episode. So it's great to. Be a part of that broadcast, at least for a moment, like going to actual powwow in our backyard.
Yeah. And maybe we will broadcast from there. That's a good idea. We should. I mean, yes, it is right in our backyard, and I'm ashamed that I never went before and that I knew so little about what's going on. And I purport to be interested in this sort of thing. You know, we watch APTN, and, we're interested in Native news. And, in Canada, it's all over the place. Not only are there Native networks, but CBC and CTV, they have Native programs themselves and parts of the news that are devoted to what's going on in Native communities. And here, we just don't talk about it. And that's sad. We need to do better. We need to do much better.
It's a huge blind spot, in my opinion, and that there's just a lot lost in that. On all the way around, in all sides and in every direction, and to be alienated in a time when we have so much more information about why and how and what's going on. I don't know. Just I'm glad we made the short trip and experienced it after having kind of talked about it. They get some signs and some
right.
visual stuff. I think social media maybe might be helping. Nowadays, and of course, after not being public for the last several years, so I think the awareness is that much higher now, and we're just able to we're finally stopped talking about going,
right.
I wasn't even thinking of it when we talked about it the other week, but it seemed like the right way to spend the weekend.
And Native communities are actually in the news on a much more negative note in the last couple of days up in Canada with the mass stabbing that took place up there in a First Nations community. And you hear the chiefs, the leaders of the community, front and center, saying, we have to stop with addictions, drugs, alcohol. It's killing our community. You know, it's they're not pointing the finger. Basically, it is colonialism. There's no question about that. But they're not claiming that there isn't a problem. There is a big problem in many communities, and it has to do with poverty. It has to do with the way people have been treated. Has to do with residential schools, and that is something that you can't turn away from. And it's very good to confront it. But we all have to confront it. We all have to work together to solve these problems.
And when you are a part of something like that, you begin to understand the language from that community, the ways people are speaking about their community. They're talking about healing. They're talking mm-hmm. about sobriety. They're talking about issues that are front and center, that are the now, the occurring, you know, challenge. So I think that when you understand that language, and then, of course, the kinds of history that wasn't your history, but to kind of empathize and understand where people are coming from a bit more than maybe say, let's say, comes naturally in our culture, you become, I think, maybe a indirect ally, but you're like basically a much more educated and able to approach the kind of reconciliation that really actually needs to happen, like the broader healing, I think.
And reconciliation happens when you communicate, when you participate. And that's what I think more of us need to be able to do, to learn more. Like, you know, I there's so much I don't know, and I'm trying to learn more about the communities and how they tie together and, you know, what can make it better. I mentioned to a friend of mine that I was going out there, and I got this text back with a little history lesson. I don't know where it came from, but I don't doubt that these are facts. And if they're not facts, I'm sure somebody will write in to us and tell us. But this is a very important short history lesson for anyone living in the Hamptons area. 10,000 years ago, we were covered in ice, and no one lived here. 9,200 years ago, the Shinnecock tribe migrated to the land they are still on. 9,100 years ago, the tribe launched whaling boats from the nearest ocean beach, from what is now called Cooper's Beach. Remember that name, Cooper's Beach. 9,100 years ago, they launched from there. 5,000 years ago, in Europe, Stonehenge was built. 4,500 years ago, the Great Pyramids were built. 2,000 years ago, Jesus was born, if that be your faith. 400 years ago, Europeans invaded Shinnecock land and settled a town and named it Southampton. 200 years ago, when freed African slaves arrived, the town of Southampton thought it right to put the freed people on the Shinnecock territory as opposed to mixing with the whites. And, you know, that might answer the question as to why so many people in the Shinnecock tribe and other tribes are African or book African American. Because of that decision. 100 years ago, after illegal scheming, the town of Southampton acquired the land now known as Shinnecock Hills and Shinnecock Golf Club. 84 years ago, the great hurricane hit and Southampton had no fresh water due to the pumps running on electricity. However, Shinnecock tribal members hand-pumped water out of their own wells and shipped it to the village of Southampton and gave it away for free, saving many lives in the process. 56 years ago, the state of New York decided they wanted to build a highway splitting the tribal lands in two, a.k.a. Route 27, again, through illegal means. Present day, Shinnecock tribal members have to pay visitors' fee to enter Cooper's Beach, the same beach that they launched from 9,100 years ago. Season parking permits are $50 for residents of Southampton Town and $400 for Shinnecock Nation members. Now, again, I don't know the source of this, but I believe it. And if anything is wrong, I will certainly correct it. But it tracks with the way Native Americans have been treated. We can do better. All right. So that was fun, educational, different, and very valuable, very, very amazing.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly going to be back and stay involved, at least aware of, like, the kinds of things that are going on and important issues with whatever the case may be with the Shinnecock Nation here in New York and all over the country. There's a lot of things going on in news and so forth. So we'll
there were so many First Nation communities throughout both the United States and Canada, and they communicate. A lot of them were here. You know, people from North Carolina were here, all across the country. It was really amazing.
Yeah, there's I think Native Twitter and all the kinds of things that you can think of going on are going on. And
how about Native TV Network? We've been talking about this forever.
We need that. I mean, the show is fantastic, and there are, I think, a lot of viewers for Reservation Dogs, but more stories like Spot News, that kind of thing, like APTN. We'd love to see that.
Native American program here on this radio station. How about that? Let's make
or
that happen.
Syndication from studios and stations on reservations or in other parts of the country, maybe in other parts of the state. It would be great to bring in an hour of, because there are a lot of low power stations and
we
stuff.
We could put together, are we doing this on the air? We could put together a network with all the shows that people are producing from around the country. That would be amazing.
We just turned the show into a producer's meeting now.
You know, maybe we could take one of the 27 NPR stations here on Long Island and, you know, convert it to that.
You think they could afford to do that? It's like removing a limb as far as they're concerned. They would be adding a lot.
You know, we have this this loaner car that we're using right now, and it has HD radio. I don't quite understand HD radio myself, but the NPR stations have three channels. Not only do they take all the frequencies, but they take three channels on each frequency, and they have all different things going on, so it's almost impossible to find anything. But they're so rich in resources. Meanwhile, we here at WUSB, we're crippled with still a small percentage of our transmitter power because our transmitter blew up earlier in the year. Good news is a new one is on the way. It's going to take some time because of supply issues, obviously. And we are also working to improve 107.3 so that the hate radio from Connecticut doesn't overpower us in the very areas that we were trying to improve our signal. Our translator needs a translator, basically. But we are trying hard. That's why you got to donate to WUSB, because every penny counts for us. Where was I going with this? Oh, yeah, and that loaner car, too, by the way, since I'm thinking about it. All the buttons are in weird places. All these features are crazy. You know, I tried to turn on the light the other day, and I
hit the SOS button.
I signaled the cops or something, because that's where the light switch is in other cars. And I'm driving. I don't have time to read things on the roof. I press the button, and all of a sudden I hear this voice talking about emergencies and things. Oh, my God. And I'm the one who's made to feel stupid, Kyle.
Wait, why are you looking at me?
I pressed the wrong button. I should know where everything is.
I just
why can't there be standards where, you know, the windshield wiper is in the same place on every vehicle, where the turn signal is there? That way people don't have to relearn it every single time they sit in the car.
So all the cars have to be the same on the inside.
And, you know, for some reason the back doors don't open. Okay, and I don't know why they don't open. There's some kind of hostage feature that's enabled. For me to open it, I have to press the little button that has an unlock icon on it. But guess what? That doesn't light up. So if you're starting the car and you're in a garage, say, and you're trying to let the other person in, you can't because you can't see where the icon is because it doesn't light up. Whereas all the other icons do light up. And it lights up if you turn the lights on, but how are you going to know that? There's more. I could keep going on. Remember, we drove cross country in that minivan, and there were all sorts of things that I was commenting on. One more thing. It beeps when you cross a double yellow line. Sometimes you have to cross a double yellow line if there's, say, you know, a bicyclist or a jogger or
a landscaping truck.
Yeah, or somebody just parked in your way and you have to pass them. But sometimes it beeps at me to warn me that I'm doing something bad, and sometimes it doesn't. And here's the thing. I was experimenting, driving over the yellow line in all different situations, thinking, okay, is it because it just got painted? It's bright yellow. Is that what does it? No? Okay. What is it? Is there some kind of special ingredient in the paint that triggers this? Does it maybe happen only every 10 minutes? Does anybody understand this? Please write to us, otw@2600.com, because otherwise I'm veering all around the streets looking like a crazy person, but all I'm trying to do is learn. I just want to learn how these things work. And, you know, you shouldn't install this technology. You don't want people to experiment with it. Just like, you know, the speed signs. you know, I want to know, does it go past 99? You know, it says how fast you're going. Is there a one there? What happens if you hit 99? One day I'll find out, but I'm just curious by nature.
You can't explain away driving like a drunken sailor as you testing your lane maintaining alert system, whatever the heck it is. So maybe try a closed loop, like track or some kind of parking lot. But that doesn't have the lines that you want. You want all the line, the good ones, you know, the ones out on the the main roads.
I had to pass all the way around somebody today, and it had, you know, super double yellow lines, you know, where it's, you know, you can fit a car in them, and it didn't do anything. Didn't do a thing. So I don't know what's going on. And one more thing. This car, it reminds you when you have something in your back seat. You know, at first I thought it was just a courtesy thing, but then I realized, no, this only happens when I actually do have something back there. So it's keeping track. It's really kind of scary.
I think it's for, like, if you leave a pet or a small creature.
But don't you see, we're basically getting used to having everything taken care of for us. You can't parallel park by yourself. The car will do it for you. You know, if you back up, you don't have to turn around anymore. There's a camera there. Hopefully it's accurate. and now, you know, anything you leave in your car, it's going to remind you about that. But the other problem is, occasionally it beeps and it's trying to tell you something. And yesterday, for instance, it beeped at me while I was sitting at a light. I don't know what that was about. I looked at the dashboard and there was a message there, but it disappeared. And it was a long message, too. But I don't have time to read messages while I'm driving. So I don't know what it was trying to tell me. It was trying to tell me something. And don't get me started about Waze, too, the app to get places. My God, they want me to talk to people while I'm driving. They want me to be part of a social network and you know, send greetings. And their one of their alert tones is a car horn. I mean, how stupid is that? You're driving along and there's a car horn coming from an app that you might think is a real car horn. Guys, really, I just want to drive. I just want to get places. I want to make it into a big social event until I get to where I'm going. I'm sorry.
That was a lot.
It's my day. It's
in depth.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully last. So this special master thing with Trump. Oh my God.
It's ridiculous.
I cannot believe this. For those emerging from comas, just awakening and don't know what happened. Basically, the Trump appointed judge that Trump was asking to appoint a special master to basically interfere with the case the Department of Justice is building against him, followed his orders and appointed a special master. It's unprecedented. I want to read you something from the New York Times today. A federal judge's extraordinary decision on Monday to interject in the criminal investigation into former President Trump's hoarding of sensitive government documents and his Florida residence showed unusual solicitude to him. That's according to legal specialists. This was an unprecedented intervention by a federal district judge into the middle of an ongoing federal criminal and national security investigation, said Stephen Vladeck, a law professor at the University of Texas. Siding with Mr. Trump, the judge, Eileen Cannon, ordered the appointment of an independent arbiter to review the more than 11,000 government records the FBI seized in its search of Mar-a-Lago last month. She granted the arbiter, known as the special master, broad powers that extended beyond filtering materials that were potentially subject to attorney-client privilege to also include executive privilege. Now, Judge Cannon is a Trump appointee who sits on the Federal District Court for the Southern District of Florida. She also blocked federal prosecutors from further examining the seized materials for the investigation until the special master had completed a review. Yeah, so all of a sudden now the Department of Justice has no power because of a Trump-appointed judge. Now, is it me or does it make any sense for someone to appoint a judge and then have that judge rule on legal matters concerning you? It seems like a real conflict of interest. And I think this is illustrating that perfectly. He appointed her. She should have recused herself or been removed. Because obviously she has some kind of allegiance to him. this is unprecedented. This is way beyond what anyone expected her to do. And it's getting in the way of the case, which, by the way, so much of it has already been made public, which is kind of ironic because Trump was insisting that that this be made public, and when it was, it just made him look really, really bad. Had that not happened, we might never have known the magnitude of what we already know. We wouldn't have known about the empty folders that once had classified materials. You know, we wouldn't have known about things labeled top secret that were mixed in with all kinds of other paraphernalia that he was saving. We wouldn't have known how easy it was for people at Mar-a-Lago to gain access to this. It's already out there. But now they're not allowed to do anything with it until the special master is appointed. And okay, how does that work exactly? You know, they have to both agree. And think about this for a second. The Department of Justice and Trump's lawyers, that traveling carnival of idiots, they have to agree that, yes, this person will be fair. I mean, can you imagine that happening? Can you imagine the Department of Justice accepting anyone that Trump's lawyers come up with? And vice versa, Trump's lawyers aren't going to accept anyone who's actually going to do a good job. So they're going to be basically at a stalemate. What happens then? And don't tell me the judge is going to decide, because then you have a situation where Trump's judge is basically picking somebody to keep the Department of Justice at bay. I mean, I am losing so much faith in our system just by watching this unfold. This is unbelievable. I was on these very airways, I was saying how proud I was to see, or maybe it was the other station, to see how one person isn't above the law, how the system is actually working. And yeah, you know, that involves sometimes taking the same side as people you often disagree with, i.e. the FBI. It happens. It happens sometimes. You have to accept that. And now we have this, which, you know, undoubtedly in another week will have taken another turn. But the reaction is just kind of stunned silence, or just people saying they can't believe it, like I'm saying right now.
Well, I'm myself, like, I think it's disappointing. I think that giving it more power than it appears to have is foolish. But yeah, the kind of justice that this is pointing to is unacceptable. And I think that, I think that the system itself can't handle any more shocks like this. Just that we're debating the facts of whether we can find out more about what's alleged here is insane. Like, I don't want to spend time thinking about whether we should look into any more of this. It's completely beyond the pale already, and it has been. So give him more power in looking at the evidence and telling us how it is? No. We've been listening nonstop to him and his cronies tell us how it should be and how we should sit around and play by the rules that they completely ignore. I'm sorry. We're not doing that anymore.
Uh-huh.
Period. He's done.
Yeah, I'd like to say that. I'd like to prove that. But things like this keep happening. That's, you know, when you build up all these pieces, you're playing a chess game. Not that Trump understands chess at all, but these are all pieces that he set up for exactly this kind of scenario. She was appointed actually after he lost the election. He nominated her in May of 2020. The Senate confirmed her on November 12th, 9 days after he lost re-election. Now, while people are surprised that a special master was ordered, the real surprise is how it happened, because she could have done this, but she could have done it in a much more modest fashion. Ryan Goodman, a New York University law professor, says Judge Cannon had a reasonable path she could have taken to appoint a special master to review documents for attorney-client privilege and allow the criminal investigation to continue otherwise. Instead, she chose a radical path. Yeah. That's what we're looking at. So, I think, you know, the whole premise of judges being arbiters of justice is kind of falling apart. With the Supreme Court, with this, people are really realizing that it's become a political appointee's nest. And
why follow rules?
Why follow rules?
Well, why? I mean,
they don't follow rules on the other side. You know, if the shoe was on the other foot, they just would ignore the judge's ruling. They would. And it's something to say that obviously this side will follow whatever they are told to do. Although I do think an appeal is probably going to be happening, but that slows down the entire process. And probably pushes it past Election Day, which is, I'm sure, the goal. Meanwhile, in the media, all you hear from the right wing is, what about Hunter Biden? the same week that it was revealed that that Trump's kids made $2 billion from the Saudis? I don't even know a lot about this because there's only enough, you know, so many hours in a week. But such obvious corruption. And you keep bringing up these Hillary's emails and Hunter Biden, whatever you think he did, it pales in comparison. It is a false equivalency, and it's disgusting. It really is disgusting to see what these people stoop to. But I still have faith. I still think that if we put pressure on, it's really up to us, people like you and me. And, of course, it's up to what we do on Election Day. Because that really sends the message. If we allow this, it's over. It's really over.
I just see it as more broadly connected to a wider allowance and permissiveness towards greed and corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And it just further infuriates me. And I think that the outcome had better be good. Because I think that there's just, again, no more strain and stress on this system can be had. It's too much. You've pushed people too far.
Yeah.
And to have someone sell out our national secrets, even to be alleged to have done that, I don't care who your supporters are. You're finished. You are not at all a part of the functioning accepted parts of society. You've joined the ranks of seditionists and treasonous scurrilous scumbags. Like, we don't want a part of you. You're done. Goodbye.
Well, let's make that happen. But we have to keep our cool because there's going to be so much frustration like this, and they're counting on people just giving up. And walking away and saying it's over. So, yeah, it's a mess out there. It really is pretty insane and crazy, but I can't say I'm surprised. Can't say I'm surprised at all. All right, let's shift gears because this is taking a turn into something depressing, and I really don't want to get into that. I want to get back into my old records. I'm listening to old records every night now. Just to get away from it all, and
doesn't make it better.
No, it doesn't, but it at least gets me away from the headlines. I'm going back listening to Top 100 for every single year starting in 1946, and there's some gems that come up every now and then. Here's a piece from someone named Betty Barclay. Now, in 1946, there wasn't much in the way of women's liberation. And one could argue that it's declining today as well. This song came out. It's called I'm a Big Girl Now. It's a novelty song. Get this. It was written by Al Hoffman, Milton Drake, and Jerry Livingston. Three guys. Three guys wrote this song, I'm a Big Girl Now. Yeah. It was recorded in 1946 by American bandleader Sammy Kaye, another guy. And the vocals are, as I mentioned, by singer Betty Barclay. I'm reading a Wikipedia page on this. Guess who the only person is that doesn't have a Wikipedia page? Yep, Betty Barclay. Everyone else has a history, but not the singer. This song was considered kind of revolutionary at the time because it was about a woman who was demanding her, I don't want to say rights because it really wasn't much. She was basically demanding that she stop being treated like a baby so that someone else could take care of her instead. Yeah. not much, but it's a step. Let's fire up the old 78 and listen.
Me and my childhood sweetheart have come to the parting of the ways. He still treats me like he did in our baby days. I'm a little bit older and a little bit bolder since both of us were three. I'm a little more padded. Something new has been added. He ought to take one good look at me. I'm a big girl now. I want to be daring like a big girl now. When Daddy tells those certain jokes, it isn't fair. He tells me I'm too young and makes me take the air. But I could tell a couple that would curl his hair. I'm a big girl now. I'm a big girl now. I want to be handled like a big girl now. I'm tired of being babied like a kid of three. I'm tired of having chaperones to follow me. I want to have some secrets in my diary. I'm a big girl now. I'm a big girl now. I want to be cuddled like a big girl now. I'm through with going to movies with my Uncle Tim. Through with going to picnics with my old Aunt Min. I want to go to Mexico with, you know, him. I'm a big girl now. I'm a big girl now. I want to be wanted like a big girl now. I'm tired of staying home each evening after dark. Tired of being dynamite without a spark. I want to learn what fellows do in Central Park. I'm a big girl now.
Yeah, and that's what people thought being a big girl was in 1946. Not being treated like you were three. What do the guys do in Central Park anyway? I don't know what that's all about. But, yeah, that was basically considered a bit revolutionary. Betty Barclay. A more positive thing that happened in that year was a precursor to rock and roll by a guy named Lionel Hampton, who basically put out a song called Hey Baba Rebop. Song's lead vocals were performed by Lionel Hampton himself. Song went to number one on the R&B jukebox chart for 16 non-consecutive weeks, but it never made it to the top 100. In fact, I didn't hear this song until recently because it wasn't in the top 100. But basically, this is kind of like one of those nonsense words type songs that a lot of rock and roll songs are. And this was historic. This was major, and this was hardly heard by anybody on radio stations back then.
bebop.
Hey, bop, 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 bebop.
Yes, your baby knows. But Bill Brown told old King Tut, said if you can't say rebop, keep your big mouth shut. Saying, hey, bop, rebop.
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 Yes, your baby knows. Mama's on the chair. Papa's on the cot. Baby's on the floor, blowing his natural top. Saying, hey, bop, rebop.
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 Yes, your baby knows.
It's really amazing when you listen to something almost at random and you get all this history from it. Just looking at a Wikipedia page about this particular song, the pianist Jelly Roll Morton said it'd be Bapa Liba, which is related to this. It's a riff so old it's got whiskers, close to the one on Boogie Woogie, recorded by Jimmy Rushing with Count Basie in 1937. But the scat wording apparently derives from E Bapa Liba, a song performed by saxophonist and band leader Jim Wynn in the early 1940s with his band, the Bapa Libbins. By that time, the term bebop or similar terms like bop-rebop were becoming popular among musicians to describe the new forms of jazz being performed by such musicians as Dizzy Gillespie. And there's also this basic piece about the precursor to rock and roll. The cut immediately gets fired up with Lionel Hampton's trademark two-finger piano lick, as it beckons to hipsters of all stripes. He's joined by the rhythm section, which establishes a solid boogie-woogie tempo leading up to the catchy chorus. The verses are offered in a halting style with a combo accenting the first downbeat, then laying out for the other three in the measure. It goes on and on and on about all these things, and it all ties together. And you can just see music unfolding year by year. The use of nonsense syllables to convey excitement was passed on in later years in such songs as Gene Vincent's Bebop-a-Lula, Little Richard's, I don't know if I can say this, Wabba-Baba-Lubop-Alam-Bam-Boom in Tutti Frutti. Yeah, probably the first time I ever said that. But, you know, all is not lost. While this version was not heard very much on mainstream radio, you did get a white version. We're just going to listen to a little bit of this.
Hey, Bob Reba.
Hey, Bob Reba.
Yes, my baby
I mean, it's okay, but it doesn't have that soul, you know? That is Tex Beneke with the Glenn Miller Orchestra, and that reached number four in 1946. It's, you know, it's pretty amazing just to, with almost every piece, learning some more, finding other tracks as a result of that, and it's very therapeutic. Kind of gets you away from the headlines. I recommend it, Kyle. I do.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for taking us all down that interesting memory lane there. What year did you say that was again?
1946.
Amazing. It sounds so good, too.
Well, you know, a lot of this came from archive.org, which has an immense library of 78s. And that's how you know you're getting the right version, because, you know, there weren't any fake 78s that came out back in the 1940s. That's one good thing about that era. But I'm actually up to 1961 now, so I'm sort of moving up. It's going to take a long, long time, but very educational, learning so much about music. And things are accessible, too, which they weren't a few years ago. You would have to basically track down a lot of either vinyl or compact discs or things like that. And now there's a lot available online that you can get quickly. So, anyway, that's pretty much it as for the musical part of this show. I guess otw@2600.com remains our email address. And if we have a message to leave people with, it's not to get discouraged by the headlines, by what's been going on in the world, because, you know, there's always surprises. I guarantee you there are surprises on the way. I guarantee you when things look bad, it inspires people to push back. And the people, that's us. So let's not take it too seriously, but let's take it seriously enough so that we don't let them get away with it. And I think we'll be all right. All right, again, otw@2600.com is our email address. And we're going to go out with... get that damn 78 off the turntable. We're going to go out with one more version of that song by a guy named Holger Zucke, a German musician. And this was recorded, I believe, in the 1980s. He was big with the band Can, C-A-N. And it's very, very hard to look them up online because you just can't look up the word Can. It doesn't work on search engines. But this is another version of that song, more modern. It all ties together. You learn all these things. I had only known this version before. Stay tuned for Finn. He's coming up next. I'll see you next week. Good night. Bye.
Hey, Bob Reba.
Hey, Bob Reba.
Hey, Bob Reba.
Hey, Bob Reba.
Gotta catch you in the groove. Get your body really moving.